But I had this view of Twitter, especially for ELT development, as this really nice place where everyone was helpful and everyone was supportive, and it was really amazing. You'll notice I'm using past tense here because I'm not quite sure that that's the case. I feel like maybe that negativity or cynicism or whatever sort of crept into the ELT Twitter sphere.
Hello and welcome to ELT WTF. This week, WTF stands for Why Are You Twitter Famous? We'll be talking to my friend and frequent collaborator, Michael the Griffin Griffin, about teacher training and using social media for teacher development. Mike is a teacher and blogger based in Seoul, trains teachers with the New School in New York, runs a small press ELT publishing company, the ELT Workshop, with me. Mike is also one of the funniest people I know, and I had a really good time recording this episode with him. So I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed making it. If you listen after the closing music, there's some bonus content. After we finished the official interview, we took a bit of a deep dive into the relationship between teachers, teacher trainers, and training course providers. Mike has spent a lot of time in Korea, so I started off by asking him how it's changed over the years.
That's a question that often comes to my mind. The first time I came to Korea was in the year 2000 when you were in elementary school. At that time, the kind of people that came were not so interested in Korea, it seemed. They were just there because it was something different. They were just there for a job. They were just there because it was easy to get a job. They wanted to get some experience before they went to Japan. They wanted to take a kind of gap year and get some money. But what I've seen lately is a lot more people are more interested in teaching, more interested in EFL, more interested in a career. So that's one big change I've seen. In terms of the market in Korea, I feel like Korean consumers of English education are a lot more savvy. I think in the past, Korean moms just wanted a native speaker and any native speaker would do. But now I think that's kind of changing.
So why have you stayed in Korea for such a long time, unlike those other people?
Well, it wasn't my plan, Tim. Well, I first came to Korea intending to stay for 1 year out of a 5-year plan. And my 5-year plan was to go to five different places all around the world, and then kind of settle down and start a quote, real life. But then for whatever reason, jobs or personal life reasons, I stayed in Korea for 2 years, 2.5 years, 3 years for a while at that time. And then I worked in Japan. I did my CELTA. I traveled, did a couple other things. And then I was on this weird cycle between Korea and Japan. I'd work for 3 months in Japan, travel some, and then work for a month in Korea at a winter camp. So Korea was still very much part of my schedule. I did that almost for 3 full years, this kind of cycle. Then I came back kind of full time for a while, not intending to stay very long. And then I kind of just fell into this job that I love in Seoul in 2010. And it's been difficult to leave.
And why? What is the job you love so much, and why? What do you love about it?
So I work at a university here in Seoul, and I have basically two types of students. The first are future interpreters, or translators. And my class is a kind of a strange class because every week is like a little mini conference. Students come to class prepared with a speech in Korean that they read, and their classmates simultaneously interpret into English. The room is set up with booths all around, four booths all around. And then we listen to the interpretation and give some feedback, and then sort of sift through the language issues on the English side and talk about things as a group. What did you say here? How could we say this better? I'm really stuck on this part. So class is very interesting for me. It appeals to some of my personal, more esoteric interests, like politics and policy and very small grammar and nuance points of English. So it's really an interesting kind of class because I learn so much. And the questions that come up are kind of interesting about how to organize speeches and how we might say different things. There's cultural elements. So the whole thing is just really fascinating for me. And also, I don't have to plan very much. So it's kind of interesting to try and make the most productive class as possible. But students are choosing the speech. Students are organizing who speaks when. So our class is really just what we talk about from the issues that arise in their interpretation. My second type of student is in an international studies program. It's actually an English-only program. So they study economics and politics and business and all these things in English medium graduate school. So that's quite interesting as well.
In an article in 2015, you wrote that Korea is a dynamic hub for professional development in ELT. Can you tell me a bit more about that, please?
I'd like to mention that the title was slightly tongue-in-cheek. The Korean government is known for having all these slogans that they wanted to pursue, like hub and imagine your Korea is maybe the latest one and all this kind of thing. But on a serious note, I think Korea is a fantastic place for professional development for teachers. To start with the public sector, public school teachers in Korea, I only know about English, really, English teachers. They have lots of opportunities for development. And then there's lots of organizations like COTESOL is one that comes to mind. The conference is actually coming up next weekend. And one of your interviewees, alumni of this podcast, Scott Thornberry, will be here, so that would be great. But I want to say that there's lots of opportunities. COTESOL has chapters all around Korea in the sort of major cities. Basically, once a month, those chapters would have a meeting. Then there's conferences, bigger conferences, smaller conferences, other events. So there's just a lot going on. There's lots of teachers trying to do different things. It's kind of an exciting, dynamic hub in terms of professional development.
Talking of professional development, you do a lot of professional development, but I'm also kind of aware it's quite easy for teachers to just turn up, cash the paycheck, and go home. So why did you do so much extra on top of your job?
I think mostly because it's fun. I just kind of get a kick out of it. It's not like I'm not the type to be so like focused on, okay, I'm going to learn this skill or that skill, or I'm going to develop in this area. Like, I'm not so organized with it necessarily, but I just enjoy talking to other teachers. And in terms of presenting, I just kind of get a little bit of a rush out of it, a little bit of a thrill out of it. I like to challenge myself and try to do a different type of presentation, different type of workshop, try and push the boundaries of what might be acceptable or normal or whatever. So it's basically just a little bit of fun. I'm not sure, to be honest with you, Tim, how much of a better teacher I am from doing 10 presentations a year for other teachers. I'm not sure it really helps my development in the classroom or my teaching, but I enjoy it and I think it's fun. The phrase that keeps coming to mind is get a kick out of it. I just think it's a little bit of fun, a little bit of a rush.
Do you think what you try and get from professional development in terms of presenting and blogging and all of these other things, has that changed over time or has that remained fairly static?
I suppose it's probably changed in some way. The background on why I got so interested in presenting is kind of interesting. I used to do trainer training courses a fair amount of the time. So it was sort of helping Korean public school teachers be a resource in their schools and districts and stuff and kind of be a mentor for other teachers, including giving feedback, running feedback sessions, this kind of thing. And part of this course was about workshops and presentations. And so I was running these sessions, helping them to do those sessions. And to that point, I hadn't done many sessions on my own. And I just sort of felt like a fraud. How am I telling these people what to do, how to do a presentation, how to do a workshop when I've only done two or three or four or five, whatever it was in my life? So I became very aggressive, assertive, eager, whatever, to start trying to present as much as possible. In the early stages, it was just so I didn't feel like a fraud when I ran sessions on running sessions. So I would say, yeah, it probably has changed a lot. At first, I just wanted to get that little bit of background so I didn't feel like a big liar. And then now I just do it for fun when the opportunity is right.
So at the moment, you're teaching an MATSOL at the New School in New York. What do you think students get from an MA in TSOL?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think it's actually quite different from program to program. And I think people often just assume that there's a lot of similarities. I think my simple answer is that it depends. Speaking from what I think my students get, so I think each program is different. So it really, there's a lot of variation. Some programs have lots of emphasis on practical things. Some have a focus on theoretical things or writing papers and things like this. What I think I noticed from the New School program is that it's really a chance for students to examine their beliefs and examine their choices on teaching and what they're doing and why in this reflective type of thinking. So I think that's probably the biggest thing that I notice. In addition to teaching the curriculum development course, I've also done some work on portfolios, which is the final project that students do. And I've seen their collection of their work over the 2, 3, 4, 5 year span. And I can see a lot of development in terms of thinking about teaching, talking about teaching, reflecting about their work, reflecting about their role as teachers. But again, my disclaimer would be it really depends from program to program. And I think that's interesting in the way it should be, because not everybody has the same interests or goals.
Is there anything you wish teacher trainees that you've taught, not necessarily just in the MA, but maybe just generally, is there anything you wish your trainees knew?
Sure. I think the biggest thing is this idea of a rule of thumb. Yeah, usually we try and do this. Usually we say this. So I think sometimes these things become ingrained and they seem like rules, official rules that you must follow all the time. So I think it's tough to help people get to a certain place with guidelines, suggestions, ideas, rules of thumb. But I feel like all too often this kind of statement comes off to be do it like this forever. And then 10 years later, people have this ingrained habit and they haven't really examined why they're doing it or where it came from. So for me, among the biggest things I would like to be clear about, if possible, in my training courses is that, yeah, context changes, you change, students change, things change. So you want to be flexible with it and think about a lot of statements as a rule of thumb rather than a strict rule. A friend of mine often talks about tools, not rules. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. I'm reminded of something like a concept checking question or instruction checking question where, like, when you first start in a training course, this is something that's really appealing and something you might want to latch onto as a training course participant, as a trainee. And then as you get experience, maybe you can make your instructions clearer and you don't need to use instruction checking questions so much, but you still have that habit. I've written about this on my blog about how kind of this kind of habit or overuse of instruction checking questions, or the cult of ICQs, I believe I called it. And I think that's just one small example of how something that can be useful, something that is useful, becomes ingrained and becomes a habit. But we don't examine it in a complete way.
And so do you think this kind of MA course is quite good for getting rid of those ingrained habits?
I do think so. I think it can be. I mean, again, it depends on the focus of the MA, depends on how theoretical, practical, academic it is. But yeah, I think it can be.
What do you think the relationship between research and practical teaching is?
My current thought is that we see lots of bad-mouthing of teachers for not reading the research. Oh, teachers don't have time. Teachers aren't interested. Teachers don't read research. Teachers simply don't read research. I think maybe then research should be more digestible, should be more interesting, should be written in a way that teachers want to read it.
Do you think there's anything that does make research quite hard to digest for teachers?
Well, I think research is written for researchers. It's not written for teachers. And maybe that is an efficient way to do it. But I just don't know. I think the whole thing is that people are just writing research for the sake of writing research, for the sake of getting points, for the sake of, you know, keeping their job, which is fine. I understand that. But I think lots of research is not really written with teachers in mind. And I don't want to say that's a bad thing, but I think it's a fact. So I think we can't expect teachers to read stuff that's not written with them in mind.
Wait, because I wanted to talk the second part of the interview about social media and blogging, because you do a lot of work which is written for teachers and it is very easy for teachers to digest. I wanted to start by asking you, what do you think social media for professional development in English language teaching looks like?
I suppose if you asked me 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, my answer might be a bit different. But I see a lot of groups on Facebook where people are sharing links. In the past, I had this ideal vision or view of Twitter as this ideal place that was sort of outside the rest of the world. Like if you talk to people about Twitter, their first thought is about Trump or other idiots like Kanye or whoever. I think if you talk to lay people, by that I mean non-teachers, they have this negative view of Twitter where people are just firing off opinions or just, you know, trying to get a rise out of people. But I had this view of Twitter, especially for ELT development, as this really nice place where everyone was helpful and everyone was supportive and it was really amazing. You'll notice I'm using past tense here because I'm not quite sure that that's the case. I feel like maybe that negativity or cynicism or whatever sort of crept into the ELT Twitter sphere. I think that's okay. I mean, I think it's natural maybe. But also, I think it's a little bit sad or disappointing. And I can't say that I haven't played a role. I'm just as snarky and cynical as anybody. To bring it back to Cotisol, I was at the Cotisol International Conference in 2011, so just about 7 years ago. And I went to a session run by Chuck Sandy, who you know. Chuck was talking about ITDI before it was really unveiled. And he was talking about community and he was talking about his journey as a teacher and educator and person and what was valuable to him. And it was a really powerful and amazing talk. And I guess I'd known Chuck a little bit online before that and seen his books, but I didn't really know him as a person. And his talk was just amazing, inspiring, and fantastic. And in his talk, he had this one little throwaway line. It was not even like part of his talk. It It was just seemed to me to be a throwaway line. He said, oh, Twitter's great. Get on Twitter. Trust me. And it was like minute 32 of a 50-minute talk. And it was not a big emphasis. It, you know, he didn't have a slide for it or anything. It was just seemed like an off-the-cuff remark. And so I was like, oh, I'll try it out. This was 2011. I think Twitter became pretty popular, say 2009. Maybe it was really unveiled 2006, 2007. So it was, I knew what it was. I knew about it. But I followed Chuck's advice and it was amazing. It was really just eye-opening to be in contact with all these passionate, committed educators all around the world. And at that time, I didn't have a blog. I didn't really have an interest in a blog, but there was all these conversations going, and this was way back in the old days when you had 140 characters. In my day, didn't have all this 280 business, none of these GIFs. Yes, I said GIFs.
Okay, granddad.
and so it the blog just seemed like a natural extension of that, because there was all these conversations happening and I wanted to engage and I wanted to share my ideas and things like that. So I just started the blog as an extension of Twitter, just so I could contribute and kind of respond to people and share my own ideas. Through being on Twitter, my eyes were open to all these amazing blogs that were out there. And it was really great to get a glimpse into classrooms around the world and see what people were saying and learning more about teacher training and things like that. I should also say, at that time, 2011 is when I joined Twitter. I finished my MA in 2009 or 2010. And then I started doing a lot of teacher training and got trained up to be an SIT TESOL trainer. And that was just an amazing world learning SIT TESOL course. And that was just an amazing group of people that I worked with. And we had these great conversations and I learned so much. And I examining teaching, examining my beliefs, talking about the best way to do this, all these talks. And then I moved out of that context and I started my work here in Seoul. So I was sort of missing these deep, detailed conversations about teaching. And then all of a sudden I was right back into it online on Twitter and blogs and stuff like that.
Now, do you have any highlights from blogging or tweeting?
I suppose most of the highlights have been face-to-face meetings that sort of stemmed from tweeting or stemmed from blogging. One time in 2013, I was at CAM TESOL in Cambodia, which is an excellent conference that I strongly recommend. And I got on a bus, minibus, for a day tour of teacher training centers around Phnom Penh. And I just sat down next to this guy on the bus and he said, are you Mike from ELT Rants, Reviews, Reflections? And I was like, yes. It was the first time I'd ever been noticed. And this gentleman, Tim Knight in Tokyo, was a super nice guy and I enjoyed getting to know him and chatting with him, and was the first time that I was like, wow, people are actually reading this crap. Somebody knew me from the internet rather than already knowing me. And it's not all about ego, but it was just nice to know that someone was reading my nonsense there.
You're going to disagree with me when I ask this question. However, your Twitter profile and blog are very popular and successful. What do you think is the secret to that success?
I am going to disagree. And I'm also going to disagree. What do we mean by successful here?
Well, okay, that's a good question. So what do you think it means to be successful? What do you define as success when you write a blog post?
Hits. Glorious hits. No, I'm joking. Sincerely, a blog post that's successful for me, it gets me thinking, gets other people thinking, ideally maybe makes someone laugh somewhere, at some point. That's probably about it. Sometimes, honestly, it's really on my end, like it's just cathartic. I have this thing that I just want to say and just want to get it out of my system. So that's probably the other side, is just I feel like I want to sit down and write something up. I want to share it with the world, this quirky idea or whatever.
And do you think there's any reason why people do follow your blog a lot and do follow your Twitter a lot? Is there any reason why you think that is?
Honestly, it's a little bit tough to talk about yourself, but for you, Tim, I'll answer anything. I honestly think it's about being authentic and being a real person and you know, making mistakes and trying out some bad jokes, trying out different things, trying out different style of posts, trying out talking and writing in different ways, being sort of vulnerable, trying to have a laugh, being yourself, being a real authentic person, I think goes a long way. I think lots of blogs are not exactly my style. I'm sure they're useful. Are just like, here's what you need to do on Monday. Here's the best way to review Present Perfect or whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with it, but that just doesn't appeal to me. So I kind of think maybe sometimes I write what would appeal to me or just what I feel like doing. It's my own damn blog, you know? So yeah, I think there's a lot of value in being authentic. I'm not writing for anyone else, but if people enjoy it, that's really great, and I'm happy about it. I had a few cases where people asked me to write something kind of promotional for them in the ELT world, and if I didn't really believe in it, it felt a little bit weird. But this has been on my mind a little bit lately, is like, if they offered me $1 million, I would say Headway is the best book ever. I'll happily say Interchange 3, the red one, love it. I'll say that for the right amount of money. But anything less than that, I think being authentic is the way to go.
Do you have any blogs you'd recommend to someone who doesn't currently read ELT blogs but was maybe interested in getting started?
Three blogs that come to mind for different reasons that I'd like to share. One is Hannah Ticha, who's in the Czech Republic. She's a very prolific writer. She writes quite often and has all types of different posts and examines her teaching, relates to conferences she's seeing, relates to questions she's having with grammar or other things. And it's really personal and well-written and I think a really nice example. The other blog that comes to mind, I just kind of thought of three off the top of my head. So the second blog I'd like to recommend is by Jeff Jordan. He's had a few different blogs and blog titles. His current one is What Do You Think You're Doing? It's addressed to teacher trainers, a critique of teacher trainers. And Jeff sort of examines big issues in the field and thinks about why the field is the way it is and how things could be better. He says a critique, it's kind of in a critical way, but it's very interesting, and there's a lot of food for thought. So I would definitely recommend it. Your question was for people who are not reading blogs at the moment. I'm not sure if this is the first blog that you would read because it's pretty kind of high level, but it's certainly interesting and certainly worth a read. And the third blog I would recommend, he actually hasn't written so much lately, but it's among my favorites ever, and that's from Kevin Stein, and it's called The Other Things Matter, which I think is a brilliant title, and it's all about his experience teaching in Japan, and he's just a fantastic writer and a deep thinker, and it's well worth a read. You asked before about excellent moments of blogging. Meeting Kevin was among them, because we both started blogging at around the same time in 2011, 2012, so I would like to give a little shout out to Kevin, especially for people who are kind of new to whether it's Twitter or blogs and stuff. Maybe they haven't seen much from Kevin, but it's definitely worth reading his whole blog. I celebrate his entire catalog.
Thanks again to Mike for coming on the show. Stick around for a little while to hear some bonus material where we nerd out about teacher engagement and teacher training. Next week, we're going to mix things up a little bit and it'll just be me on the show. Look forward to seeing you then.
Let's come back to that blog by Jeffrey Jordan, the new series he's been writing about teacher trainers. One of the critiques he gives is that teacher trainers are maybe giving a single way of teaching rather than teaching the trainee teachers to be critical and to engage with different methods of teaching and to be critical of methods that are taught. How much do you agree with that assessment, or is there anything you'd say about that?
I love the question, Tim. So on Jeffrey Jordan's blog, he has his questions and he says, I invite teacher trainers to answer the following questions. What is your view of the English language? How do you transmit this view to teachers? How do you think people learn an L2? How do you explain language learning to teachers? What types of syllabuses do you discuss with teachers? Which type do you recommend to them? Question 4, what materials do you recommend? 5, what methodological principles do you discuss with teachers? Which do you recommend to them? And I feel like sometimes those questions might be not the way that training courses go, because maybe the training course kind of has this communicative language teaching focus already baked into it. So I think these questions are really useful and interesting, but I also feel like maybe lots of training courses, yes, I think I'm talking about the CELTA here, there's not a lot of time or room or place on the syllabus to get into what type of syllabuses are discussed with teachers. That's not really part of the course. I think it's a very important question and something we should consider, but I'm not sure that teacher trainers on a 120-hour course are really getting into it. Now, we might say they should be, and I say, okay, fine. There's probably a lot that could be considered, but then what gets eliminated from it? So I think I think those questions are definitely worthwhile. When I tried to just answer them on my own, I was thinking, you know what? I don't really transmit my view of the English language very often on a training course. I'm a hired person to deliver a course that's kind of written or whatever. There's objectives that I'm given that I try and do my best to help the participants get to. So I think those questions are super worthwhile, but I'm not sure that average trainer is engaging them. And maybe an average trainer should be. And so I think Jeff is on an interesting track.
Sorry, do you think the average teacher is engaging in those questions, and do you think they should be?
Yeah, I don't think they are, but I think maybe they should be. I think, what is your view of the English language? That's a good place to start. If you're gonna ask 20 questions, why wouldn't that be one of them?
I guess, yeah. So the counterpoint is something I've been thinking about a lot this week, is something like the noticing hypothesis, which, and like in a very pure form, the idea is that if you can't notice specific features of language, you can't learn them. And I spent a lot of time last week, hours and hours that I should have spent doing something that, like, I get paid money for, thinking about this and reading about this and trying to find out more about this idea and, like, is this idea true or not? And at some point, I just sat there and thought, like, well, it doesn't matter if it's theoretically possible to learn a language without noticing something. It matters, is it helpful to notice things? Is that a catalyst for learning language? It doesn't really matter if it's a prerequisite. So for me personally, I'm starting to consider how many of these questions we ask ourselves in applied linguistics do really matter to teachers. Like, do you think a lot of them do really change the way people teach, or should they be changing the ways people teach?
To go back to your example, I mean, I think the term noticing, I don't know how important it is, but like this thing that Richard Smith called noticing, I'm not sure how important that is, but I think these are important questions. Yeah. How do you think people learn an L2? If you have some rough idea, I think that you can then employ that in your decision-making process. And I think if you're not thinking about that, then your choices are going to be just following, we're back to headway, right? Following the textbook that you're given, or following the rules of your boss or school or whoever is not you that's making those decisions. So I think, how do you think people learn an L2? I think we should have some ideas about it, for sure.